Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a discussion with Andrew Edstrom, author of the new book, Why Buy Bitcoin, available now on Amazon. But first, we've got our weekly check-in with Swan Bitcoin. Now, if you haven't heard, the makers of Give Bitcoin, which launched at the start of the holiday season last year and made a splash as a new way to convert your friends and family from no-coiners to wizened toddlers with a one-year escrow and world-class education. The next product from the makers of Give Bitcoin is Swan Bitcoin, and I'm just incredibly excited about this one. I'm excited because Swan is a Bitcoin-only product focused on one simple goal: to help you save as much Bitcoin as you can with low fees and easy recurring buys. That's it. It's focused on doing one job better than any other product, and that's the kind of product I like to hire. You can sign up now for early access to the product, and I really hope you do so. Just take a few seconds right now, open up your browser, go to swanbitcoin.com, that's SWANbitcoin.com, and add your email address, that's all it takes, and Swan will be in touch when ready for Bitcoiners like you to help put the new app through its paces. Swan will be launching soon in 49 states. Sorry again to New York, the bit license sucks. But seriously, guys, I'd love to show Swan the reach of this podcast. It would be great for the pod if you could just take a few seconds, sign up for early access at swanbitcoin.com. Thank you so much. Okay, and just a quick shout out to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Big love to LTBN for bringing this podcast onto the network. LTBN has already had great Bitcoin pods like Let's Talk Bitcoin with Adam Levine and Andreas Antonopoulos, and What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick. But it's really improving the feed by adding more Bitcoin pods like Bitcoin & Co. with Anita Posh, Weekly Bits from Bitcoin Magazine, select episodes from the Cryptoeconomy podcast with Guy Swan, and of course this podcast. There's also one of my fave pods, POV Crypto, which isn't a Bitcoin-only pod, but there are plenty of episodes focused only on Bitcoin, and it's really fun to listen to one of my favorite Bitcoiners, CK Snarks, take it to the ETH heads with gusto on that podcast. So check out the LTBN feed for those Bitcoin pods in one convenient place. And don't forget that you can find the archive of Citizen Bitcoin podcasts, almost 70 episodes deep now, at citizenbitcoin.world. Lots of great episodes to catch up on if you are relatively new here. All right, let's get this thing going. Andy Edstrom is a wealth manager who has fallen down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. He started writing content to justify a small stake in Bitcoin for his clients, and that turned into the new book, Why Buy Bitcoin? It's a great book for family and friends thinking about an investment in Bitcoin. Andy's history in the finance industry gives him a valuable perspective. He's one of the early adopters of Bitcoin from the industry, and in this episode, we get into that history and perspective. We discuss where the finance industry currently is in terms of moving toward embracing Bitcoin as an asset. We talk about monetary maximalism and how Bitcoin might change our economy. And as any good wealth manager would do, Andy has a thorough examination of Bitcoin's risk as an investment in the closing chapters of his book. And so we discuss them. It was really a pleasure to talk with Andy. Here we go. All right, really excited to welcome Andy Edstrom. He's a wealth manager who has recently fallen down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and written a book for his clients originally, but I think it's a great book for all Bitcoiners. It's called Why Buy Bitcoin? So check it out. Andy, welcome to the show, man. How are you doing?
I'm great, Brady. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic. Excited to talk to you today. Congratulations on the book, man.
Oh, thank you, man. I'm psyched to talk to you about it. Been a fan of Citizen Bitcoin for a long time. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I when we were doing a pre-interview, you played for me a little clip of me shouting out a review from like last June. You had left a review and I was like, hey, thanks Andrew Edstrom for the nice review. And it was really cool to hear that, man.
Yeah, that's
so you've been
right.
Listening for a long time.
That's right. It was middle of last year. And, I was deep in the pods, deep in yours. Yours was one of my favorites and you were, I mean, I'm sure you can talk about, you know, how the pods developed over time, but but you were at the time were still commenting that reviews were helpful. And so I was like, all right, sweet. I'll give him one. So well deserved.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. Definitely was helpful back then. Still is helpful if y'all want to leave a review. I wouldn't mind. And same if you read Andy's book, you know, and this goes for any Bitcoin content out there. It's super helpful to leave reviews on podcasts and books, you know, claps on Medium articles, share them out on Twitter, all that stuff. We are the marketing team for Bitcoin. So we all got to kind of share the love around.
Amen.
Yeah. All right, let's dive in, man. You did one pod, and I'll refer people back to this, your first one on the Bitcoin circuit with Colin at the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast. That was a really good episode. Definitely recommend people go back and check that one out if you want some more Andy after this one. So that was good, but I want to dive into your story first because it's, you know, you are kind of new to the scene here, and I want to get it out to all the listeners out there. You sort of represent the front end of this emerging trend in the finance industry. Veterans really diving into Bitcoin. You know, it's kind of like slowly then suddenly, as Parker Lewis would put it. This is it's slow now, but I think we'll probably see it really kind of drive you know a lot more quickly or in the coming years. What prepared you to recognize Bitcoin a little earlier than most of your peers in the financial industry?
Yeah, so that's a good question. You're definitely right. I come from the evil finance establishment. I was born on the dark side, or raised on the dark side, and what prepared me for it? The short answer is I wasn't very well prepared for it because, you know, I went to college and I studied economics. And of course, it was Keynesian economics. So I am a default Keynesian, like so many others out there, of whom you've talked to. And then I went to work on Wall Street. So I was sort of, you know, eyeballs deep in the financial establishment almost from day one, working at Goldman Sachs and then subsequently working in private equity and then at a hedge fund and now in wealth management. So in some respects, I was really poorly prepared. I can certainly, you know, I can sort of trace the arc of my, you know, professional history and kind of how I fell into Bitcoin, if that's helpful.
Yeah, let's hear it, man.
Okay, cool. So college in Massachusetts, straight to New York, working at Goldman Sachs, got a front row seat to the making of financial sausage, as they say. I was not working. this is before the financial crisis. I was not working in, you know, in the mortgage area, where some of the really egregious stuff happened. I was working with debt, though. I was working in the leverage finance area, specifically the high yield bond and leverage loan, also known as junk bonds and junk loans. So basically, you know, part of my job was helping to put together debt deals to finance leverage buyouts, as well as, you know, refinancings of debt tranches for companies that were highly indebted. So I did that for a couple years, and you know, that was like 2004, 2006. So decided to move to the private side and the investment side, and I worked briefly for a private equity fund that spun out of the Carlyle Group, which is one of the larger private equity firms around at that time and still today. And then I worked at a hedge fund. It was interesting. A fund called Tenenbaum Capital, which is located here in L.A., and about a $5 billion fund. And I joined them in 2007. And then in 2008, of course, Lehman Brothers filed bankruptcy and the financial crisis hit. So I got a front row seat to that. And lucky for me, I had joined a firm that had a pretty significant distressed debt investing practice. So there's plenty to do for a few years there. But I, you know, sort of cut my teeth on that, as well as doing other types of investing, including private equity and private debt and public bond investing and public stock investing. And then about 7 years ago, I was an associate when I joined Tenenbaum and a principal when I left. And I decided to get into the family business, which is my dad and his founding partner founded a firm called Westcap Group. And we're a wealth manager. I got interested in working with dad. I got interested in working with actual people because, you know, in the investing business, usually if you're an institutional investor, you're basically working for faceless institutions. Yes, some of them are pensions and endowments, you know, that benefit actual people, but generally you don't get to meet those people. So I was keen to work with actual living people, live people. And I was also excited to grow that business. So that was my arc. And my first exposure to Bitcoin was 2013. I read an article in The Economist. It totally went over my head, so I ignored it. 2016, read about the Dow hack and Ethereum Classic Fork. Mm-hmm. Didn't understand mm-hmm. that. And 2017 is when I started paying attention because one of my friends, Pygmy, and I think I took a look at CoinMarketCap or something, and I saw, I don't know, 10 billion or 20 billion in market cap there. And I was like, okay, well, maybe there's something here. If someone's ascribing billions of dollars of value to it, then maybe I should take a closer look. So that's the sort of the short answer to how I first got to Bitcoin. Certainly I could talk about, where that went from there and how we got to the book, but hope I answered your question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 2017, the height of the madness, it's kind of when I came into. So I presume, like most people, especially that year, that you got distracted by Ethereum and all of the tokens that were being issued on the Ethereum platform. All of the, we're going to change the world. This is the new internet. We're better than Bitcoin. Narratives that were out there. How did you, as a kind of trained investor, especially of other people's money, which requires even extra, even more due diligence perhaps than investing your own money? How did you kind of weigh all of that stuff? How did you go through the sea of all of those shitcoins and evaluate them?
Yeah, man, it was tough. It was a challenge. I mean, I wish I could say that, I was always just a Bitcoiner and I ignored the noise. And I saw the light from the beginning. No, mm-hmm. I did my fair share of altcoining. I was first probably buying Bitcoin in the, 3,000 something range. So it's not like I got it early and made a bunch of money on it. I wish I had, but mm-hmm. that was not the case. But no, I was speculating in a bunch of the altcoins. I was reading about, various, network topologies and consensus mechanisms and, Turing completeness, mm-hmm. and, efficiency, right. And DAGs and, this is a more efficient, system computationally. So it's better than Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I was deep in all that stuff. And it took me a few years to, a couple of years to come around to higher conviction that Bitcoin was the most interesting, sort of head and shoulders above the rest in terms of the investment opportunity, as well as, ability to, to change the world.
Yeah, it's a really interesting journey. It's a very psychologically challenging journey because, like you mentioned, the conviction is the thing, right? And I love the term FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, because it's so on point. And as you go through and you learn about Bitcoin, you listen to the Bitcoiners' arguments, the maximalist arguments on, why Bitcoin is a different thing. It's in a different league, right? Yeah. It's got, all of those arguments make sense, but the siren songs of all of these, alternatives to Bitcoin are really alluring, right? And definitely cast a lot of doubt and uncertainty in your mind. And developing that conviction just takes a long time. I feel like we are lowering the bar to that conviction over the past couple of years with books like yours, a lot more podcasts, a lot more educational material. What did you, find the most useful? And I mean, do you agree that we're in a better place now than we were in 2017 in terms of the time to reach conviction about Bitcoin?
Yes. Yeah, I definitely agree. And a couple of things maybe to say there. The first is there really is no substitute for time. And others, mm-hmm. Have realized this before I did. But let's say doing 100 hours a week of work and research on Bitcoin, for a month, let's say 400 hours of research or 450 hours of research is not the same as doing 1 hour, of research each week for a year, mm-hmm. right? In other words, the passage of time and the percolating of ideas in the mind are, I think, really important to deep understanding of Bitcoin. And I'll say that, you know, the narrative of, you know, whether it's Ethereum or any of the other alt projects, the narrative of money that has an intrinsic value or a utility value is really appealing, mm-hmm. unless you have, I guess, studied Austrian economics for a long period of time. And it takes a while. It took me a while, really, to understand the fact that the best money has no intrinsic value or has no value as anything other than money. And until you really get that, until that really sinks in, all the other, you know, all the other stuff, the noise is much more appealing. So that's one comment. And I guess the other thing I'd say is, yeah, we're definitely in a better place today. We're in a better place for a couple reasons. You know, one is there's more and better material. And, you know, I saw an opportunity in the market for my book specifically when I wrote it, because at the time there was, I felt what was missing in the market was, you know, there were some more shorter / perfunctory, you know, books that didn't cover enough. And then there were some longer books that were, in my opinion, too long form and risked, you know, turning off some people who are interested in learning. So I was looking for a sweet spot in the middle with my book. So that's one thing. And then, of course, the Lindy, I would argue, the Lindy of Bitcoin looks a lot different today than it did, say, 2 years ago, right? I mean, the narrative, the altcoin narrative is real strong in late 2017. And having come through a cycle since then and having seen Bitcoin, you know, mostly suck the air out of the rest of the crypto market, certainly adds to the fact pattern of the last decade plus that, yeah, it already looked, I mean, you could make the argument in retrospect that a few years ago, it already looked like Bitcoin was the winner, but now it looks like it more so. So there's definitely greater conviction with the passage of time. But I agree with you that there's more and better material coming to market. And, you know, I hope to play my small part in that.
Yeah. And I think you're right about that. Like the fact that there were, and it's not just that Bitcoin has kind of sucked the air out of the crypto market. I guess the opposite way to put it is that there were so many failed promises from these ICOs and just dead projects that didn't deliver. They raised hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars and haven't delivered any working product of value.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so that's 100% right. So many projects that just totally failed, basically failed to launch. And then you've got the longer, more established projects, or somewhat more established, you know, using Ether as an example, you know, which are still trying to change consensus mechanism, you know, and are still, you know, forking every now and then. And they haven't, as you say, they haven't delivered on the promise even of basically re-architecting the consensus mechanism. So as an investor, you're saying, okay, if Bitcoin has won the digital gold category, which, you know, fairly clearly it has, then, you know, how is anything that's about to still change itself materially in terms of how it operates going to hope to compete with that? And I think it's really hard. It's going to have to be something that's much, much better. And this many years into it, it's getting more difficult to imagine what that contender or that competitor is.
Yeah. Where do you fall on the idea of monetary maximalism? You know, the idea that we could sustain an economy or a market with several different monies. Is that something that you see possible in the long run?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's it's a little bit hard to say. I would say I'm pretty monetary maximalist in the very long run, with the caveat that, and this is a framework I lay out in the book, if there's 14 significant characteristics of money, 14 characteristics of good money, no money is going to score, you know, highly on all of them, and there will be some groups of people or entities, or there will be times when people want to use a certain type of money rather than another. So I'm never gonna say, yeah, it's winner take all 100%. I think that, you know, I think Pareto distribution, I think power law makes a lot of sense. I have a certain amount of humility about what the end game looks like and how long it's going to take. I mean, it's when you look through history, it's sort of amazing that you've had hegemonic currencies backed by empires, whether it's the US or the UK or Spain or Holland or what have you. Those things can hold their positions for, you know, a century and mm-hmm. or more. And so there's the caveat of, you know, how long it takes to get to the ultimate end game. I am pretty bullish on Bitcoin's ability to become, you know, the money and the base currency. But I also allow for the possibility that, you know, fiat currencies, various fiat currencies, as well as, who knows, other forms of money, whether they're, you know, alt currencies, could have some modest monetary premium. It's just that it's going to be probably orders of magnitude, depending on the case, mm-hmm. lower than Bitcoin. So that's kind of my thought process, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's a...
Sorry, and it could take a long time, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a very reasoned answer. And I think that's important to stress that, you know, these network effects also apply to, you know, existing fiat monies, like the dollar has mm-hmm. massive network effects, right? And it's going to take, you know, a long time to slow those network effects down. The idea of hyper-Bitcoinization kind of counters that a little bit, you know, it makes it sound, at least most of the time I've heard people talk about hyper-Bitcoinization, it seems that it's kind of the idea that it's going to happen very quickly, like over a matter of a few years at some point, there's going to be this tipping point and everyone's just going to, you know, start dumping fiat for Bitcoin. And that's just going to create this, you know, chain effect that you know, people just are going to want to get out of that money that's, you know, hyperinflating and losing its value relative to Bitcoin. So do you think that tipping point will happen at some point, or do you think it's going to be more of like a decades long process?
Yeah, it's very possible. I'm humble enough to say that I don't have any conviction on the answer. I mean, I can make the case, you know, you look back at 2017 and it felt like, oh, you know, we're going hyper Bitcoinization, you know, right now. This is, mm-hmm. we're going to moon. This is happening now. You know, there are wallets out there, you know, Coinbase can't open accounts fast enough. Everybody's piling in, et cetera, et cetera. I could make the case that that's going to, you know, happen maybe in the next cycle. However, I do have the humility to realize that, and actually it's partly interaction with, you know, my clients as an example, to realize that there are a lot of people in the world who take time to learn and they are cautious with respect to investing or allocating their capital to something that is, let's say, not new, right? We're more than a decade into Bitcoin, but let's say relatively new and challenging a much longer and more established order. So yeah, I can imagine a scenario where it takes decades, or I can imagine a scenario where there's a tipping point. And then the question is, well, what, you know, what caused the tipping point? Was it just, you know, FOMO plus, as you say, watching number go up, or inverting it, you know, watching number go down for every other type of money? Or is it some political event, or is it, you know, basically some catalyst from central banks like the Fed or larger governments on the fiscal side that cause a tipping point and basically a speculative attack on fiat, whether it's a dollar or something else? And so I allow for both those potential outcomes. And either way, the investment thesis for Bitcoin, you know, looks pretty good. And by the way, I'll say that, you know, the book, the numbers I sketch out are, I allow for a decade long, when I sort of set the price target or I set the upside case from an investment point of view, I take a 10-year view. And I think the total valuation on 10 years that I use is about $8 trillion. And, you know, that comes from various buckets, whether it's, you know, taking share from gold or taking share from fiat or taking share from offshore assets, you know, or, you know, slightly demonetizing other stores of value like real estate, you know, or new uses that either we haven't thought of or are still under construction, you know, whether it's, you know, micropayments or things enabled by Lightning, you know, or it's, you know, it's Abra, you know, or similar systems whereby you can get synthetic exposure to any asset in the world just by, you know, holding just by holding Bitcoin as collateral. So there's all these areas of upside, and the valuation that I use is the one I laid out. So that's, I don't know. Some would say that's aggressive. Some would say that's, you know, conservative. But I think that getting to multiple trillions of value on a 10-year view could either happen through Bitcoinization or hyper-Bitcoinization, you know, or it could happen in the form of, oh, that's one more decade of the evolution of this thing. We've already had one decade. The second decade will, you know, could be that much bigger. And then maybe in the third decade it happens. So we'll see.
We will see. And it's going to be really fun to watch it happen. Yeah. It's sort of a privilege, I guess, to be here when we look back sort of at the relative beginning of this whole thing. And it's going to be fun to watch. Let's go back to the idea of like that trend of financial professionals, just the finance industry in general, learning about and coming to understand Bitcoin. Is the financial industry moving into Bitcoin? We've been talking about this for a couple of years. We do see more infrastructure in place that would be able to support, you know, movements of large amounts of capital on the order that these financial institutions deal with. We've got a couple of leaders like ICE and the backed company that ICE owns and has developed, and Fidelity. Do you think we're going to see, you know, in this, if we have a coming bull run, do you think we're going to see more interest from the financial industry?
Yes. So there's a couple ways to frame that. So there's the examples you laid out, right? There's ICE is the largest exchange company in the world, period, I believe, right? They own a bunch of stock exchanges. They own New York Stock Exchange. They own a bunch of them in foreign countries as well. So they're a huge player. And then Fidelity, you know, which manages, I don't know, $2.5 trillion or something of assets, and then custodies like $6 or $7 trillion, right? Because they got all these 401k programs and retirement programs that they custody. These are big, real players. Now, if I step across the table back to the dark side where I came from, from the establishment, the financial establishment, you know, I could care less whether a company named Zappo or a company named Bitco, you know, has quote unquote qualified custody.
Right.
I start to care when Fidelity and the New York Stock Exchange's parent company, you know, are real. So that is definitely in my mind a shift. So that's one thing. Another factor, of course, is price, as you point out. And, you know, when we take out the previous all-time high, right, when we're back at above 1920K, that's going to be a catalyst that some people who aren't paying attention now will pay attention to. And then I think the story as well, let me back up. 10 years, a decade of the best performing asset, right? That stat came out at the end of 2019. That's important.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And I think, the excuses for ignoring it are falling away with time. And I think one way to think about that, by the way, is when I think about my clients, some people say, well, you know, how do you pitch your client, or how do you explain Bitcoin to your client? Okay. Mm-hmm. One thing I sometimes like to do is invert it. I say, okay, look forward into the future. It's, I don't know, 2022 or something. And Bitcoin has, let's say, already, plowed through six figures, right, on price. And I'm imagining my conversation with my client, and my client is saying, okay, do we own any Bitcoin? No, we don't own any Bitcoin. Oh, so a few years ago, it was the best performing asset of the decade, right? Yeah, that's true. And it was uncorrelated to other assets, right? I mean, it had less than, 0.2 correlation to the U.S. stock market, foreign developed stock markets, emerging markets, you know, bonds as measured by the Barclays Index, gold. Yeah, that's right. It was not correlated. Oh, and the total addressable market was in the tens of trillions of dollars, correct? Yeah, that's right. Oh, and it it was investable, right? Like there were, you know, instruments in the market that you could buy. Like you could buy this in my, you know, in my account, right? Yeah, yeah, that's true. Okay, so what am I paying you for? Like, what? And you know, the answer to that is, well, my clients do pay me for other services as well. You know, I do financial planning and give them advice on other stuff. But if you are a an institutional investor, whether you're a wealth manager acting on behalf of others, or you're, you know, a fund manager, the number of excuses that you have for ignoring this thing are falling away with every day that goes by. And these are all factors that I think that institutional investors are going to have to be thinking about very carefully right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. That sort of back and forth that we just went through is you talking to other wealth managers about the potential for Bitcoin. Like you're going to have a client here in 3 or 4 years that is going to talk to you like this. Is that?
Yeah, that's either me talking to other wealth managers or it's me talk, or maybe it's the client, you know, quizzing me, right? Because,
right.
You know, and that's going to depend on the client. Like I have actually quite a few very sophisticated clients who do read the news and they do pay attention. And so, you know, I had a client ask me actually a few months ago. He said, Andy, what's the next Amazon? Right. And he didn't, what he meant by that was not literally, you know, like what is the next, you know, web-based retailer slash cloud business? No, he meant, what is the next thing? I don't know if he meant internet native or internet enabled, but he meant, what is the next thing that could create, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars or trillions of dollars of market capitalization that is, you know, either off the radar or hasn't sort of fully been discovered or realized by the market in general. So yeah, it's all of the above. It's clients, it's other wealth managers, it's anybody running a fund, you know, anybody running a macro fund, for example, who has the mandate to trade just about anything out there. And as long as it can be safely custodied, you know, it ought to be on their radar. And they're going to have a good reason for not owning it, you know, in the future if it regardless of how it performs.
So have you had an opportunity to talk to other wealth managers and financial advisors about Bitcoin? Are you finding ways to get this book into their hands as well as your clients?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I was sort of featured on a call that Bitwise did. So Bitwise is one of the companies that is focused on getting, you know, Bitcoin into the hands of investors, including wealth management specifically. And so basically they set up a call, you know, Hunter, who's the CEO of the company, went through the basic thesis on Bitcoin. And then we kind of did Q&A at the end of the call. And there were, I think, between 400 and 500, you know, wealth managers that called it and listened to the spiel. So yeah, I am, you know, I'm trying to bring the message to others in my line of work, because I think it's important that they be aware of it. I think it's important that they finally do the work to understand it. And look, some have, but it's, I would say, the minority. And yeah, so I'm doing my best to amplify the signal.
I think that's great. I think it's really important to get that information out to the finance industry. Like what you're talking about, like it's kind of a trickle right now, but educating them is, you know, it has this sort of multiplying effect for educating the consumer who might be investing in it, because, you know, the reach of the financial industry, wealth managers, financial advisors, et cetera, is huge. And it's getting, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, kind of Gen Xers, you know, older millennials, and then, you know, of course, like younger boomers who are kind of looking to retire, you know, in their 50s. Trying to think about, you know, retirement coming up, and it's starting to, you know, get maybe wanting to get a little bit more aggressive if they're a bit behind, you know, but there's still kind of a 10 or 15 year time horizon to play with. So if I'm coming to you as somebody like that, you know, I've only been contributing to a Roth or a 401k, maxing that out every year, and that's all I've been doing so far. And I'm like, oh God, you know, this is coming up. I really don't want to work for another 30 years. And they come to you, you know, maybe they've heard about Bitcoin, maybe they haven't. What kind of exposure would you recommend? What, and then if you, like recommend Bitcoin? How do you make the case to someone who's like, I have no idea what this is?
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on the case, I guess. I mean, the short answer is I faced that problem, you know, in the 2017 to 2019 period. And I realized that I was going to have to write it down, you know, and I'm not going to sort of, I'm not going to convert someone on the first conversation, right?
Sure.
However, I do take a portfolio approach. So I look at the edit as a hugely asymmetric trade, right? You could make 10 to 100 times your investment. And then I probability weight it. And I conclude that, okay, there's huge potential upside here on a probability weighted basis. And then I say what I described before, which is it's low correlation to the rest of the portfolio. It sort of moves to the beat of its own drum.
Mm-hmm. And why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, that's like modern portfolio theory 101. That's mm-hmm. definitely something that resonates with wealth managers and professional investors is the holy grail, more or less, investment is something that is uncorrelated to the rest of your portfolio, but still has a huge positive expected return. Because even if something has a high positive return, well, if it's correlated to all the other risk assets, if it's correlated to stocks, if it's correlated to real estate, well, then when you get a big downturn, like we had a decade ago, more than a decade ago, the global financial crisis, well, then it's going to lose money with everything else. And you risk, as an investor, the worst possible outcome, which is panic selling the bottom, right?
Right.
And we Bitcoiners understand this viscerally. You don't have to hold Bitcoin for very long to get this feeling. But imagine it's your, you know, larger portfolio. And imagine you are in the position you just described, which is someone who's worked for, you know, decades of their life. They've scrimped and saved, and they put together a nest egg. Well, yeah, the worst thing that can happen to them is, you know, stock market's down by half. Okay, that happened, in 2009. And they panic and sell. They just can't take the pain. And by the way, this is one of the crucial things to realize as an investor is the part of the brain that is activated when this occurs is not the rational, logical prefrontal cortex. It's not this part of the brain that we've evolved in recent history, right? No, it's our lizard brain. It's those base structures, including the amygdala, where we feel fear, and that part can take over. So certainly we don't want to, you know, have a client take too much risk and then watch the volatility and see the price sink and then panic sell. However, as part of a broader portfolio, Bitcoin's really attractive. It has the low correlation. Someday it may be even viewed as a safe haven. We've seen hints of that recently, right? We saw hints of that even this week with respect to, you know, what's going on with the coronavirus. Stock markets basically around the world are down. Bitcoin's doing well. We saw that a little bit with the Iran situation recently, mm-hmm. when Bitcoin went up, when it appeared that there was heightened risk of a conflict and risk assets were going down. So we're starting to see hints of that. I don't know how long that will take. It could take a while for Bitcoin to become more of a gold-like, zero to negative correlated asset with respect to other mm-hmm. risk assets. But that's interesting to think about. And then it's also really important to think about Bitcoin as hard money and what position in a portfolio does hard money have? Well, in a world where there's too much debt, the debt is increasing, not decreasing. Mm-hmm. There's not political will to deal with the debt in the normal ways. And we can talk about sort of the menu of options for how we deal with debt as a society. And where inflation is a real possibility, you know, on a 1 to 2 decade timeline, right? I'm not saying it's going to happen like, you know, next month or next year even. Well, you better have a hard money asset, and there aren't that many of them out there, right? There's gold and there's other precious metals, and then there's digital gold. So Bitcoin has a place in the portfolio on that logic as well.
So what kind of like percentage of portfolios? I know obviously this varies with clients, but kind of in general, is it, you don't need much exposure, right? Because the risk reward kind of ratio for Bitcoin is quite high. So you can afford to risk less because the potential reward is so much higher, right?
Yes. And, you know, it's different with each client. So, you know, I have to be careful about giving specifics. But suffice to say that, you know, getting off zero, but to a small percentage, you know, 1% or 0.5%, that is a very reasonable argument. You know, for a really much more, let's say for a client who has better understanding of the thesis and the potential upside as well as the risks, and has the, you know, the actual tolerance for, let's say, volatility or loss, you could certainly go higher. You could go to several percentage points, but, you know, we're starting small. It's an education process. And, you know, the hardest step is getting off of zero and to some small allocation. And then with time, you know, we'll see if a larger allocation, you know, makes sense.
Sure. So you mentioned Bitcoin's risks, and you spend, I think, the last three or four chapters of the book, like a very responsible wealth manager should, examining the potential risks that Bitcoin has very closely. I think this is a very underappreciated, or at least we spend not enough time on this because, you know, we're bullish all in on Bitcoin, you know, and we love to get on here and just wax about poetic about how, you know, amazing Bitcoin is going to be and how it's going to change the world. And we don't spend enough time, you know, soberly examining the potential risks. And I think you do a really good job with this at the end of the book. And I thought it would be good to spend some time talking through them here.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. I appreciate that. Yeah, you're right that I approached it like a proper investment thesis where you say, okay, what's my upside and how do I quantify that? And then, yeah, how can it all go wrong? Certainly the list of FUD items, as you alluded to before, is long, but it's possible to address each of them. And I would say it's hard to literally quantify each of them, right? Mm-hmm, so what I don't do in the book is say, you know, okay, yes, there's a 2% chance of a successful 51% attack by a nation state or consortium of nation states within the next decade. So I don't take it to, you know, to that level of detail. I try to categorize it in a few categories. There's technical risks. There's political risks, there's economic risks, and then there's sociological and psychological risks. And yeah, I try to spend, I don't know, depending on the risk, I try to spend a page, maybe two, on each one to frame them and address the you know, the possibility and the probability that that any one of them is gonna occur. But look, I mean, there are. Yeah, there's obsolescence risk, and there's, you know, the question of the competitive moat, right? Which really is like, can something else, you know, replace Bitcoin? Okay, pretty unlikely, like we talked about earlier. Probably looked more likely, you know, a couple years ago, but man, tough to unseat the incumbent right now. Obviously, you've got, you know, internet access. Like, you know, if you lose access to the internet, well, then Bitcoin's not going to work. Okay, well, if internet goes down for any significant period of time, then we got bigger problems. And plus, you know, there are lots of smart people around the world who are building things like mesh networks. You know, there's the satellite. Mm-hmm. There's basically these redundant systems that that can mitigate this risk.
It'll at least keep Bitcoin alive, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And that's the, you know, I spent some time on the book on this too. I mean, I talked about potential attacks, you know, and what they would look like. The 51% attack is like so remote as to be, you know, not fully discounted, but, you know, pretty low probability that happens. I think it's a little more interesting to think about, you know, partial, let's say lower percentage hash power attacks, right? Like nation state or consortium thereof somehow manages to marshal, you know, 20% of the network. And so, you know, one out of five blocks basically is getting censored. What does that do to price? And could you have sort of a spiral that comes out of that? I mean, that's not impossible, but nevertheless, you know, I talk about the difficulty of surreptitiously, you know, accumulating hash power, plus just the economic logic of there's just more money to be made, you know, keeping the thing going rather than trying to attack it both from a capital cost perspective, right? Like getting the ASIC capacity plus spending the electricity to attack it on an ongoing basis. So I agree with you. It, you know, very hard to completely destroy it. You know, I address obviously hacking, you know, by breaking the encryption, basically. We do have to worry about quantum. This is so well understood that A, people are working on it. B, you know, the number of qubits that have been implemented in terms of quantum computing, I think, are nowhere near where they need to be. And C, we really need as a society basic encryption to work. Because, you know, whether it's ECDSA or Schnorr or basically elliptic curve in general, because so much of the internet is powered on that. So if we lose that ability, the internet's going to be pretty busted. So that tells you that there are a lot of smart cryptographers that are working on quantum resistant crypto. And the history of crypto in general, I'm talking about cryptography, is that it's the cat and mouse game, and it's been going on for decades. And so far, the encryption guys have stayed ahead of the code breakers for the most part. And so there's no good reason, I don't think, to assume that won't continue. I can't guarantee that it will, but we have some history there.
Yeah, so the asymmetric magic of cryptography, you know, and yeah, you're right. If we break that, it's gonna hurt. But yeah, there are tons of people who are preparing for such a case, and you know, quantum is, you know, I think it's in the popular media kind of overrepresented on how well developed it is at this point, and the challenges, the realistic challenges that it faces to become, you know, a sustainable, like an actually practically useful computing platform. There's a ton of challenges there.
Agreed. And plus, yeah. there's components of the, I mean, you know, the ECDSA, you know, probably gets broken first, but you know, harder to break SHA-256. So, you know, you could have some period in which you can't sort of sign transactions, but nevertheless, the history is intact. So there may be some warning time, or there may be some reaction time, basically, even if there is an attack, you know, before implementation, let's say, of quantum resistant, you know, basically a hard fork of some quantum resistant system into Bitcoin. So yeah, I don't lose too much sleep over that one. But yeah, you know, there's centralization, obviously, and I break centralization down into several different areas. I mean, obviously, you've got mining capacity, you've got node operators, you've got, you know, owners of Bitcoins, you know, because if the whales are too concentrated, you know, maybe they can wreak havoc on the system. You know, you got concentration among software devs, you know, the mining pools rather than the miners themselves. The second layer, you know, exchanges and businesses. Like I do, you know, I worry a little bit about you know, concentration of accounts at, you know, Coinbase or what have you, and the ISPs. But when I think about the history of the internet, and I think about where we are today, you know, I just think about 10 years of the thing hasn't been getting more concentrated over the last decade, right? It's been getting, all these things have gotten more and more distributed and more decentralized. And the cost of, you know, crucially, the cost of operating a node has been coming down. I do think we'll get to a place where, you know, everybody or a large portion of the population has a node on their mobile device, and that'll be great. And that'll be the realization of the notion that keeping the blockchain as small as possible and as simple as possible allows for the greatest decentralization and most robustness. And the strongest ability of nodes to resist attack by other groups in the network. So look, I mean, that's most of the technical risks. You know, political risks, that's the next section. You got government attacks, and that can take various forms. I am pretty persuaded. This is interesting too, right? When you talk about Bitcoin versus the altcoin universe. I mean, I think the mandate for innovation is pretty strong. Yes, many of our politicians are Luddites. Yes, many of them don't understand the benefit of innovation. But by and large, I think most of them do. I think most of them realize that the biggest companies in the world are all American and they're all internet-based, you know, with rare exception. And if there's a narrative behind Web 3.0, right, and decentralizing the internet, which, by the way, I believe is a possibility, right? I would like to see the internet re-architected. You know, will it happen with the, you know, based on some Turing complete, you know, altcoin? I don't know. But regardless, I think it's all in the same pool of innovation is important, and Bitcoin is part of that innovation. And the history of prohibition, you know, people definitely do worry about, oh, it's going to be illegal. It's going to become illegal in the US or it's going to become illegal in some other parts of the world. And man, the history of prohibition is ugly, right? Especially in this country. You talk about alcohol prohibition, that led to the rise of organized crime, and it didn't even stick anyway, right? Like, you can't, when people want to use a product or a service, and I think clearly people are going to want to use sound money, especially in a potential future inflationary world. Well, you know, attempting to take it away from them is going to be difficult. Not least because in America, at least, a lot of those people own guns. Shout out probably to Ragnar, who's working that angle. So yeah, it's going to be hard, I think, for the state to basically make it illegal. Now, there could be a period of prohibition. This, by the way, is one of my personal motivations. Okay, I think Bitcoin survives prohibition and eventually breaks prohibition if it happens. But you know what? I'd rather not live through prohibition. Okay, yeah, I'd rather get this thing widely distributed in as many hands as possible, so that enough of the population here and in other countries understands it, understands its value, and basically is active and present in the political process and discussion, if and when that conversation happens, you know, either in the next bull run or the one after that, when governments finally have their, you know, had their panic moment about, oh, this thing is big and real, you know, and it's $1 trillion plus valuation, and it may be disruptive. So that's on the political side. You know, you got terrorism and criminals. You got all the usual mainstream media FUD. That is both real and an opportunity, right? The story of the mainstream media FUD is the reason that when I talk with some clients about it, or when I initially talked to them about it, they said, oh, Bitcoin, and the, you know, and they talk about dark markets, you know, or money laundering, you know, things of that nature. And that is the prevailing narrative still with most of the population, I believe. It's certainly, been the prevailing narrative with my clients. And some of that is generational, right? I have plenty of boomer clients. That is a narrative that is common, but man, when you run the numbers, and I have this in the book, right? The UN itself estimates global money laundering is on the order of $800 billion to $2 trillion, right? Which itself is multiples of the entire value of the Bitcoin network. Right. And we know that happens in dollars mostly, right? The best thing I
shout out Steve Mnuchin.
Shout out Steve Mnuchin. That's right. Exactly. And man, it's I've had a client ask me, yeah, about, you know, committing crime, you know, with Bitcoin. And I said, you know, please use physical dollars, much less traceable than Bitcoin. The over $1 trillion worth of $100 bills that are outside the US's borders, right? This is the Federal Reserve's own estimates. Those probably aren't used to buy bread and milk in developing countries. Yes, some people use them legitimately as store of value, but yeah, you know, what can those dollars be used for? So it's all relative. So I think it's, you know, the it's incumbent on the person arguing that, you know, Bitcoin is criminal money, it's incumbent on them to prove that, you know, that Bitcoin is used for crime more than the dollar is used for crime. And I haven't seen any, you know, convincing evidence of that. So, yeah, so there's you know, what else is there? Economic risks. I mean, there's obviously the volatility. You know, I talk about the 14 characteristics of good money. I differentiate between short-term volatility and long-term volatility.
Sure.
Certainly short-term volatility, you know, makes Bitcoin a less usable medium of exchange today. But as we think, the volatility will decrease with time. And if we end up in an inflationary environment, then people will worry less about the short-term volatility and care more about the long-term, you know, the long-term volatility, i.e. the loss of value for dollars and fiat over time. You know, there's market manipulation. That's an interesting one, I think, for institutional investors. And that is an ongoing issue. I think the strongest argument there is you look at to commodity markets, whether it's gold or any other, and you say, you know, no global commodity, you know, whether Bitcoin, gold, or oil or anything else is unmanipulated. So it's really, it's only a matter of degree. And I think with the more time that goes by, the less manipulated probably the Bitcoin market will be. So time is on our side on that one. And
when it comes to market manipulation, I mean, a lot of that is a factor of centralization of the actual ownership of the asset, right? So mm-hmm. I guess if, like, compared to, like, it's much easier to manipulate an asset that is less well distributed, right? Because you can, if it's more of it's in the hands of a few people, then it's more vulnerable to manipulation. How does that express, I mean, how does manipulation happen in Bitcoin? How do we see that play out?
Yeah, I think that, well, one obvious one, this was actually highlighted, I think, in the Bitwise report that got released, I don't know, middle of last year or something, is you just see transaction volumes as reported by the Bitcoin and crypto exchanges. And some of the numbers are just clearly, you know, ridiculous, right? Like it appears to be wash trading. Well, it's either mm-hmm. wash trading, right? One party selling to another party and they're both, you know, effectively the same party, just trying to show volume, or the exchanges are just lying. And it's a range of behavior, I think, among the exchanges, you know, the ones that are domiciled in the US and or generally tend to take a compliant view in whatever jurisdiction they operate, you know, we can probably believe their volumes more than we can believe the volumes reported by exchanges that are in either weaker jurisdictions or are, you know, moving around jurisdiction to jurisdiction and jurisdiction shopping, right? Or have basically, you know, made no claims about, let's say, legitimacy and compliance. So I think that's the main piece of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Do we see, like, so some of the traders call this the inverse BART pattern, where it looks like some whale dumps a bunch of Bitcoin and then, you know, lets the price sort of stabilize at some, you know, lower price, and then just buys it all back up again, the same amount back up again to, you know, basically increase their Bitcoin holdings by, you know, 5-10%.
Yeah.
Does that happen?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I honestly, I sort of assume, in some respects, I assume the worst, right? What do we know? Well, we do know that early adopters, you know, whales basically have decent chunks of this stuff. That's one thing we know. The other thing we know is there are certain venues, maybe without calling any out by name, where you can use high leverage, and there are jurisdictions that are, let's say, off the beaten path.
Right.
And so, you know, we know that in those, first of all, on those exchanges where there is high leverage, mm-hmm. you know, you can, a sizable trade can basically push the price and cause a cascade of liquidations, right?
Right.
You know, which causes a significant move. So we know those things can happen, and therefore they probably do happen. And not only probably do because they can, but also because I think about, you know, you mentioned the manipulator side. I'm thinking of the other side too, which is, you know, if you're a leveraged, basically if you can trade on 20x or 50x or 100x leverage, that's going to trade, that's going to attract a decent amount of people who just like to gamble, right?
Right.
Humans like to gamble, some more than others, but there's enough of us on the planet that if you had, if, you know, some small percentage of the global population of adults can either log in direct or hop on a VPN and get access to huge leverage on a, you know, on a highly volatile asset, well, they're going to play around. So there's going to be demand for that. And yeah, the large traders can take advantage of that.
Sure. It makes sense.
Yeah. So anyway, I guess, you know, going back to some of the major risks, you know, there's the narrative, obviously. There's, you know, there's naysayers in the media, and I cover, you know, comments by, you know, whatever, Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon and Charlie Munger and all these guys. And you just have to remember these comments, they will stall this, you know, they will stall adoption, right? Like if Charlie Munger calls Bitcoin, you know, rat poison squared or whatever he called it, yeah, institutional investors and average people care about that statement, but it kind of only delays the inevitable. And when you layer on the second level of thinking and you realize that all these guys who have huge stakes in the existing financial system,
right?
Especially the guys who have stakes in the banks, right? I mean, you know, any bank CEO is going to talk badly about Bitcoin. You know, Munger and Buffett, I think last looked at the Berkshire Holdings, you know, they held something like $50 billion worth of, you know, Bank of America and Wells Fargo stock. So all these guys have skin in the game. You know, I talk about Howard Marks. Howard Marks, really smart investor, runs or is chairman of Oak Tree Capital here in LA, big alternative asset manager. You know, he basically came out against it and then he changed his mind. And I give him credit for changing his mind. I also observe that his funds and his firm and his investment strategy are probably less exposed to competition and downside, you know, from Bitcoin than, say, the banking industry. So it's all kind of a piece, right? It all fits a pattern with respect to who has the most to lose in terms of market share and business, you know, and revenue and market cap from Bitcoin success. Those are the guys, and it's mostly guys, you know, who are going to be talking about it negatively. Now,
yeah, and it's, yeah, go ahead. It's also just 1 second, but there's almost like a lot of these people too. One, like just talking about it, right? Like these people with large megaphones, just talking about it helps Bitcoin in some regard. Like people are going to listen to that and be like, all right, Jamie Dimon, I respect him. And you know, I'm going to follow his opinion for the most part. Right. But you know, they're talking about Bitcoin and that means something as well. So that's also a signal, just the fact that like the, you know, the chairman of Goldman Sachs has to come out, or JP Morgan, sorry, has to come out and talk about Bitcoin because it's actually something that he needs to consider. It's like important enough for him to consider is also a signal, I think, too.
Absolutely.
So, you know, yeah, there seems to be a bit of a Streisand effect to some of these, some of this FUD and these negative events that happen around Bitcoin.
I agree 100%. And moreover, you layer on the sort of larger trust narrative, right? You look at the stats, I've got a few in the book on, you know, trust in government, trust in Congress, trust in Wall Street. I mean, you know, it was funny. I discussed this on the other pod, so I won't get into it here. But when I wrote the book, I thought real hard about, you know, how much can I talk about or how much am I willing to say that's negative about either Goldman or the banking industry or particular individuals? I mean, I thought about liability and I thought about getting sued. And then I realized, you know, these guys, rightly so, you know, the banking industry and the leadership thereof are so untrusted and disliked that they don't need, you know, I don't know, ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs doesn't need the bad press of, you know, suing some small-time wealth manager / author, you know, for bringing to light the behavior of the banking system. So no doubt the general level of trust in financial institutions and government in general, coupled with establishment players, you know, like the ones we just talked about, you know, talking bad about Bitcoin, coupled with, oh, it hasn't failed yet. oh, look, you know, yeah, the price is down off the peak, but, you know, it cratered and now it's come back and it's still not dead. Maybe there's something to this thing. Maybe I should pay attention to it. Maybe the powers that be that I don't trust as much as I used to, say before the financial crisis, maybe they're trying to pull the wool over my eyes and maybe I ought to pay attention to this thing.
Maybe they're accumulating while they talk about, there's definitely an incentive to do that. Use your megaphone to try to drive down price and stack your sats.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is. Yeah. So another, you know, another big piece of FUD I think is environmental. That one is real, at least as, in terms of adoption, and it plays into, you know, altcoins, for example, plays into proof of stake coins. I've been working on exploring this one. I touch on it in the book. And I think for an intelligent, you know, reader or listener or investor, I think it's useful to talk about unit cost of production and, you know, what Bitcoin is doing basically to the renewable energy market. And I think the pretty compelling argument is, you know, it's been said that Bitcoin is the first global market for energy because electricity is transmittable over, you know, 100 miles or 200 miles, but not over thousands of miles. So there are plenty of cases of stranded assets. These are stranded source of energy in the world that are not near population centers. And many of those are renewable, right? It's hydro in China. It's geothermal in Iceland. I mean, yes, there are people in Iceland, but there's only like 300,000 of them, right? So there's no way that the local population can use all that energy. There are, you know, windy parts of the world that are not next to cities. There are sunny parts of the world that are not next to cities, right? Large parts of Africa, you know, Morocco, places adjacent to the Sahara. And so when people talk about, you know, use of energy basically in Bitcoin, yes, there's no doubt that there's some dirty coal being consumed. I think the coin, is it CoinShares, has a report on mining that they put out periodically. I don't know if it's annual or every 6 months. That suggests that maybe the majority of energy usage in Bitcoin today is already renewable. And why that matters is because the advancement of renewable technologies depends on the cost being lowered, and the cost being lowered depends on better R&D budgets, and better R&D budgets for companies that make solar panels, right, that make wind farms, depend on higher volume of production. So the story with, you know, renewable energies, and you can, if anybody who's talking to somebody about energy usage in Bitcoin, you know, invoke Tesla, right? Brilliantly, Elon Musk managed to get basically government subsidy for every Tesla car, you know, that he sells. So, you know, every green-minded, wealthy person in West LA who wants to go spend whatever, 80 grand on a Tesla, you know, 10 grand of that comes from the government, or at least it used to be the case. I don't know if it still is subsidized. Yeah. What's the logic for that? Why do governments do that? Well, the idea is that if you can increase unit production of, say, solar cells, well, that will allow you to reduce, you know, well, to reduce the cost per unit of energy produced, or increase the efficiency. So if solar cells, you know, used to be 2% efficient, right? If 2% of the energy that hit that cell was actually harnessed, well, then we got to 5% and 10% and higher than that. And so if Bitcoin allows for previously stranded sources of energy to come online, and if that, if the form of that energy is those remote sources, whether it's hydro or solar or wind, that's actually going to increase the units of solar panels that are sold, of wind turbines that are sold, which should over time reduce the cost of production of these forms of technology and energy, and should actually potentially allow them to become competitive with non-renewable, dirty fossil fuels. That takes time, and it's harder to think about and understand that because, you know, at the proximate, you know, question is, oh, well, are they burning coal, or are they using solar? But that's, I think, is the way to think about capital cost and R&D cost, and actually making these renewable forms of energy competitive in the long run. Because, you know, I'm all in favor, honestly, of taxing externalities, right? I'm in favor of taxing carbon, and I'm in favor of the consumer basically bearing the fully loaded cost, including pollution and carbon, you know, of whatever energy they consume. The problem with that is, as you know, you've got large emerging countries, China, India. These guys have to lift their populations out of poverty by any means necessary. And they don't have the luxury of thinking 10, 20 years, you know, into the future when it comes to, you know, global warming or climate change. Oh, and by the way, you know, the already industrialized rich countries like the US, like the UK, like Europe, like Japan, we already got to crank out a bunch of, you know, carbon earlier in our development cycles. So unless we, you know, basically pay these developing countries effectively a lot of money, a lot of value to make up for that, you know, disparity in development over long periods of time, well, you're going to have an awfully hard time convincing them basically to take the action that's required to effectively tax carbon. So, yeah, I think all these factors are really relevant to the environmental discussion. And then, of course, there's also the fact that you got, you know, guys like Upstream Data that are shipping what they call skiffs, which are containers. Yep. That have Bitcoin miners. They send them to the wellhead, you know, the gas that would have just got released into the atmosphere rather than flared. You know, you can use it to mine Bitcoin. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on, I think, in the environmental area. And we all just have to do our best to educate people on it.
Yeah, shout out to Steve Barber, who's building and running Upstream Data. And there was an episode quite a ways back at this point with Steve. But if you want to go back and look in the archive, Steve talks about his business capturing excess energy that would otherwise just be flared off into the atmosphere and turning it into Bitcoin and hashes on the network. I think all of that is really important. That's definitely a kind of a first line of attack from a lot of people. I mean, I hear it all the time when I talk to friends and acquaintances about Bitcoin. They hear them into Bitcoin and they talk about, you know, the insane amount of energy that it takes to mine for Bitcoin. And you know, if you it is kind of a difficult conversation to have because there's layers, as you were talking about, to understanding why you need to burn that energy in the first place. Yep. And how, you know, what it's producing, right? Which is the first absolutely scarce money in the history of humanity. And then you have to talk about why that's important. And yep. So I think being able to respond like, look, we're incentivizing renewable energy, right? The development of renewable energy is a really important point to make. So not only that, but let's talk about how, you know, the effects of carbon on the atmosphere and on the planet, the potential like environmental effects. Let's compare that to the effects that the fiat money regime has had on the planet, on society, psychology, politics, like the you know, just funding, you know, basically endless war. Even though we don't have wars on the, you know, sort of concentration scale of you know, like World War One and Two, we just don't fight wars in the same way, but we've had ongoing wars for decades and decades. Yeah. And that's, you know, the military is, you know, largely funded by debt that's able to be created because of, you know, the control of the money supply. So all of those things need to be taken into consideration. So I would argue, you know, that the production of, or like the shift of society from the use of a fiat money or easy money to sound money is more important than the shift from a society that is using, you know, fossil fuels to renewables. But the cool thing is with Bitcoin, we get to do both.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Right? Bitcoin fixes this and exactly. It fixes that. Yeah. These are discussions. It's so hard. It's so hard to, you know, basically get people down the rabbit hole. It's hard. It's so hard to, as Corey Clipson says, to red pill people. Yeah. And we're all doing our best to figure out ways, good ways of doing it. Certainly it doesn't help that our educational institutions don't teach any of this stuff, right? Like I got the usual Keynesian tropes and treatment in college. So yeah, we just, we all have to do our best to come up with as many angles of attack and as many exposures, you know, and repetition matters. You know, that's what I try. One of the things I try to do with the book is find a place in the market, which was neither a very simple book that didn't tell enough, nor a hugely complex and long, you know, tome that was going to turn people off or that people wouldn't get through. But I try to find a balance of covering, you know, most of the major bases in terms of basics on what is money with a little history, but not too much history. You know, the basics of how, well, the bigger picture in terms of debt and the economy overall. And, you know, you sort of alluded to that a moment ago. I mean, we can go into the bigger picture if that's something, you know, you want to talk about. But also, you know, the basics of Bitcoin and how it works. And then, yeah, the upside and the downside risks. And that's our goal, is try to educate bit by bit, little by little. We each do what we can.
Yeah, I think I'd love to jump into another topic about like talking about you write in the book really well about in a concise way about the history that sort of led up to this moment and created the need for Bitcoin. And I think it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on how would a Bitcoin-based economy change the ways that we deal with debt as a society, and then like thus, you know, how would it change the way that we develop businesses and grow an economy? You know, I hear some concerns leveled against Bitcoin about you know, deflationary spirals and inability to grow the economy without you know, maintaining some level of inflation. Those kind of Keynesian ideas. Mm-hmm. How would Bitcoin and sound money economy change the way that we, you know, operate on an economic and societal level?
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. So I do think that the equilibrium, if such a concept exists, the equilibrium level of debt would be lower, because certainly if you can lower interest rates and print money and basically incentivize people to incur debt, which is exactly what has happened.
Negative interest rates.
Exactly.
We'll pay you to take out loans.
That's right. Pay you to borrow. Bizarre. You know, over $10 trillion of debt globally with the negative interest rate. So that would be, so yeah, the level of debt would, I think, be significantly lower. There would be less reliance on use of various assets as, you know, store of value or monetary asset. So
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So definitely less people would buy real estate, you know, just to basically hold a somewhat inflation proof asset. I think that obviously the power of central banks would be curtailed. That's a clear one. With respect to, you know, deflation risk, yeah, there was something about Econ 101 and the, you know, the fear of deflation that was, you know, hammered into all of us. At least that was my experience. Deflation is not a bad thing if it comes from economic advancement and lowering in the cost of production of goods and services, right? We see that in technology. Is, you know, Moore's Law is the obvious case where computing power and the devices that we use have gotten better, faster, cheaper, smaller, more portable. But it extends really to all goods and services in the economy. And so all else equal, if your cost of food goes down or your cost of any other consumption good goes down, well, that makes you wealthier. Deflation is problematic if there's too much debt. And sadly, you know, that is where we are in the world today.
Which is why we, you know, there's no other choice at this point, is just make, you know, create more of it.
That's right. There's no other choice. It's like the, you know, it's like the junkie, you know, once he's addicted, you got two options. You can, take away the stuff and he goes through withdrawal and that's really painful.
And perhaps dies.
And perhaps dies. Exactly. Or you just keep feeding him, more and more. And it is more and more because the effect, you know, as you dose higher, you know, wears off. You have to keep dosing higher basically to get the same quote unquote short-term benefit.
And then perhaps dies.
And look, that's a very good point. And that's the, you know, the ethical perspective I take on something like Bitcoin. You talk about hyper-Bitcoinization, and there's various, you know, there's various gradations of success levels or levels of Bitcoin reaching its potential, right? Quote unquote potential. And even if Bitcoin just provides a competitive system that imposes a little more discipline right. on the existing system, the world will be better off. The world will especially be better off if, let's say, you get the hyper-Bitcoinization, you know, scenario that you mentioned. Well, man, it better happen sooner rather than later, right? Because the more debt that accumulates over longer periods of time, the more ugly is going to be the crack-up boom, as they say, as the Austrians mm-hmm. say. And so, man, you'd be better off getting off the junk sooner rather than later.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that how would building businesses change? Because, you know, the way that businesses are built now is based on so much easily attainable debt. I guess you could say it's necessary to the modern economy that we've built now because that's the way it has been built. But could we still build, an economy that is, productive to the point that we have grown accustomed to, right? The same sort of amenities and comfort and et cetera. Can we have that with a sound money economy, or not? I guess.
Yeah, I absolutely think we can because if. Mm-hmm. If a free market or a more or less free market, you know, for money or otherwise, mm-hmm. would allow, you know, would trend toward, let's say, optimal productivity overall,
right.
Well, then anything that takes us away from that natural equilibrium is inefficient and results in misallocation of capital, right?
Right.
And obviously, we have huge misallocations of capital. Okay.
Right.
Maybe there may be no better example than the education market in the US. Okay. Today, $1.5 trillion approximately of education debt, right? College debt. And there were so many people who borrowed large amounts of money to fund educations that turned out to be basically unproductive, right? I mean, right. Certainly, I'm a big believer that anyone who has the ability and the talent to benefit from higher education should have access. But when you look at the facts and circumstances, you see that a lot of people didn't even graduate, right? The graduation rate, I had the stat in the book. I can't remember what it is, but it's something like the six-year, not the four-year graduation rate, but like the six-year graduation rate for for-profit colleges is like, I don't know, 30% or something.
Wow.
It's pretty abysmal. Don't quote me on that. It's in the book. But so obviously people borrowed too much to get their educations and they're not seeing an economic payoff. So that's what's known as, effectively bad debt, right? Would we have had that bad debt incurred, if interest rates and money supply weren't so manipulated? I doubt it. There's also, an interesting thing to think about is entrepreneurship versus incumbent companies. We know that most or much of the dynamism of the U.S. economy comes from startups. We also know that it's become arguably hard. Well, in some ways, it's become easier to launch a startup because you got cloud services that can be bought, piecemeal. Rather than having a large capital expenditure up front. So that's one thing that's helped startups. However, large incumbent companies that have captured government and have their lobbyists working for them and implementing restrictions and regulations that make it harder for small companies to comply and compete, those large companies have seen their profit margins move to historical aberration levels, basically, right? Corporate profits as a percent of revenue are higher now than they've ever been in the history of the U.S. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that probably those markets have become less competitive and you've got more monopoly and oligopoly dynamics. So I guess what I can say is empirically under the current system where money is heavily manipulated, we observe more and more industries that have become more consolidated and where startups probably have a harder time competing than they otherwise would have.
Yeah, so I guess we'd have an economy that is, well, one, fairer, perhaps, at least gives a better chance to innovators to succeed and see their business ideas grow and be sustained over time, so that they would have a chance to eventually compete in the market on a more in a more level way, but also a lot less businesses and investments that are useless or unproductive, right? So I guess we just have a much more efficient economy in terms of production of actual usable assets that are, you know, helpful to society, right?
Yeah, I agree. And it's you know, you think about time preference and you think about consumption economy and keeping up with the Joneses. And yeah, I just wonder if, you know, if I couldn't finance my car purchase for $0 down and I couldn't buy my house, you know, for 10% down payment or 20% down payment, and my neighbor couldn't do that either, that would be okay. I wouldn't, right? Like, if the guy across the street buys a Maserati, you know, today, it makes me think, well, why don't I buy one too? But if, you know, if those credit-based, debt-based expenditures that, in my opinion, you know, don't really bring that much benefit to the consumer, if those were a little harder, maybe that wouldn't be the end of the world.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so, okay. I think we've hit everything on my list. I think this is a really great conversation. I did have a note here to talk a bit about the halving. And okay. This kind of goes back, I think, to this. I guess we could probably categorize this as a perhaps a political risk, or mm-hmm. maybe a technical risk, maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah.
So I know you have a kind of a unique perspective about the halving and a vulnerability that might arise every 4 years for Bitcoin.
Yeah. So yeah, I think you know, I was playing around on Twitter, and I think it was a thread maybe with Eric Wall, and somebody was talking about the halving, obviously, and someone was talking about, is that priced in, right? The perennial question, is the halving priced in or not? And this is not a discussion of, you know, efficient markets hypothesis, right? This is not a question of, do I think that Bitcoin is fairly priced or is everything priced in? Obviously not, right? Obviously, I think Bitcoin is severely underpriced, and I think it's, you know, maybe the best asymmetric trade opportunity I ever see in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying anything about the fair price. What I am wondering, though, is I am wondering if the halving itself is a fundamental event that should, in theory, you know, be positive for the price. And mm-hmm. and I'll tell you why. So imagine, you mentioned, you know, political attack or government attack. Imagine I am a government or a consortium of governments, and I'm thinking about trying to take down or attack or you know, impair the Bitcoin network. How would I do that, and when would I do that? Well, you know, when the price falls enough, right? If you get a bear market and hash power comes offline, that's probably a good time to attack the market, all else, or to attack Bitcoin, all else equal. And I'm not necessarily talking about a 51% attack. It could just be a minority attack where you're, you know, censoring transactions or mining empty blocks or what have you. And so we don't know when market downturns or price downturns like that will happen, but we do know when the block reward will reliably come down. And we're living in an era where, you know, the subsidy, the inflation component of the block reward is basically it, right? The miners, yes, they collect transaction fees, but transaction fees today are such a small percentage of the total reward that they're basically immaterial. So in theory, governments could attack Bitcoin anytime that it's weak and the price is down, and therefore the hash power falls because miners come offline. But if I'm a miner, and I'm no expert on the mining industry, but, you know, broad strokes, I think, you know, there are a few things we can say. Like, let's say I am a miner and I'm planning for the future, and it's a year from the halving. And let's say I buy an Antminer and I expect it to have a useful life of, I don't know, 18 to 24 months. Well, then I'm budgeting my capital costs, you know, plus my energy and my all my other expenditures on the idea that I'm going to mine a lot of Bitcoins. You know, I'm going to mine in 12 and a half Bitcoins per block until the halving, and then I'm only going to get 6 1/4. So probably I'm going to be significantly profitable in that initial period before the halving. But then after the halving, I'm like lucky to break even basically or make a modest profit. Well, if I'm an attacker and I know that there's going to be that event where the reward falls, I can probably assume that some portion, significant portion of the mining, you know, the hash power has basically budgeted for near zero profit or, you know, let's say zero or borderline break even on a gross basis right after the halving. So that might be the optimal time to attack the network because I can sort of tip those guys who are marginally profitable on a gross basis into negative profitability. They pull their hash power and, you know, there's more likelihood that you get sort of that spiral occurring. I'm not saying it would happen. What I am saying is that the halving is the one time when I, as an attacker, I can prepare and, you know, basically be certain that there are probably going to be more marginally profitable miners on the network that I can kind of push out of the way. And because it probably takes time to accumulate hash power to perpetrate an attack, you know, yes, governments can theoretically, you know, be accumulating hash power so that they're ready to pounce, you know, when the price is low and when the market's already weak and when there are miners who are sort of on the bubble or on the cusp. But if they can instead plan ahead for a point when they know the you know there'll be more weakness potentially or there'll be more marginal miners, then that's when they ought to attack. So the moment we get past that, you know, halving event and there is no attack, maybe we can breathe a little more easily about, okay, you know, chances are we pass that point of weakness and we're probably good for the next you know 4 years until the next halving. So that's kind of the hypothesis. You know, I've tried to engage a couple people in debate on Twitter on it, and nobody's taken the bait. But I think it's interesting to think about it as therefore being an event that is fundamental, like it should affect price. That's not to say that it will.
Sure, that makes sense. Yeah, I would love to hear any thoughts out there that listeners have to Andy's ideas there, and throw them on Twitter. Andy is at Edstrom. Andrew, is that right?
That's right. Last name, first name, Edstrom Andrew.
Yeah, Edstrom Andrew. And yeah, it would be fun to have that conversation and get it going. And I think it's an interesting idea. So let's maybe get some of those mining experts out there. I'll try to get that going too and tag a few people to see what they have to say.
Try to get them to crawl out of the woodwork. They're a secretive bunch.
Yeah. You know, they do important work, but they are definitely more behind the scenes. There's only a few that are really out making consistent noise on Twitter. But so those voices are very valuable because there's not that many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this was awesome conversation. I really appreciate your time, man. You've obviously, you know, really come up to speed on Bitcoin, know your stuff. Grab Andy's book, Why Buy Bitcoin. And, you know, I think it's a great... you know, look, you've got your mom or dad, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, who are looking to, you know, invest, save for retirements, and looking for some upside. And, you know, you're a Bitcoiner, right? So you know, we've got all kinds of books and resources to give them, but there isn't really one until now that was really focused on making the case to invest in Bitcoin in particular, right? From a wealth manager written in that voice, speaking to potential, you know, investors and savers who are looking to retire, you know, relatively soon. And, you know, even if you're, you know, not looking to retire relatively soon, that's even better, right? Like you got, you know, even more time to let that investment grow. And I think it's important to think about this, you know, make sure that you stress that this is a long-term investment. We talk about that all the time. You know, this is a decades kind of horizontal investment here. This is not something to get rich quick. It's a, as Lott puts it brilliantly, Bitcoin is not a get rich quick scheme. It's a don't get poor slowly scheme.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, and I appreciate that perspective, Brady. Been a blast talking with you about it. I'll make one promise to the reader, which is I'm better at writing than I am at talking. So
I don't know, man. You do a pretty great job. I think you're a little too humble in that regard. But
nice of you to say.
You are a very good writer as well. So you'll enjoy the book. Check it out. Add it to your collection. Andy, thanks for joining me today, man. Looking forward to talking more offline and getting to know you better and talking Bitcoin some more.
Likewise, Brady. Thanks so much, man. This was a blast.
All right. Thanks to Andy for joining me for a fun discussion. Let us know your thoughts and questions about the episode. Andy is at Edstrom Andrew. That's at EDSTROMANDREW. And I am at Citizen Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Twitter. And that's really the best way to support the podcast. Share it out on Bitcoin Twitter. Let us know a favorite quote that you had or, you know, something you didn't like even. And also share it out with your family and friends. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. And thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode. Please do go to swanbitcoin.com, sign up for early access. It'll mean a lot to me and the pod to show, you know, the reach and the impact that this podcast can have for my sponsors. And check out the LTBN, the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Thanks to them for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in the feed. And you can also check out my merch store at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and click on Citizen Bitcoin. There's some cool designs in there. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. I'd love to hear from you. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram and Keybase as well. And my email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. This week's open source shout out is LeBitcoin. LeBitcoin was the second full implementation of Bitcoin after the original client. It was announced on July 21st, 2011. It was created by a community of open source developers led by Amir Taki and Luke Dasher. Now it's headed up by Eric Voskuhl. LeBitcoin has many tools like a wallet, encrypted messaging, blockchain query service, and of course a Bitcoin full node. You can learn more about LeBitcoin at libitcoin.info. That's libitcoin.info. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.